Our final thoughts in this hour-long quest to understand the nature of tribes in our time, we have a scientific look at what it is that makes us humans separate the us from the them, and how we organize our morality around the ways we define ourselves in groups, religious affiliations, race, ethnicity, political affiliations. We've talked about all of that this hour. Scientist and author Joshua Green says it's all the same device in our brain working, a social brain machine, he calls it, for manufacturing moral decisions by relying on the behavior of the people around us. Sometimes the tribal machine works well, and other times not so well. Joshua Green is the author of Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them.
People's moral attitudes, their judgments, are heavily influenced by the people around them and by the people with whom they identify. And so a tribe, in the broader metaphorical sense that the book draws upon, is a group with a shared moral identity, a shared sense of what's right or what's wrong. And that can be a very small group. It could be a small group of hunter-gatherers living in the Amazon, or it could be a very large group, such as evangelical Christians spread all over the United States or even around the world.
And how do you think humans are wired to group themselves in tribes, or are they?
I think we absolutely are. Young children are very attuned to accents, and children who are about a year old or younger will prefer to accept a gift from someone who speaks with a native accent as opposed to someone who's perfectly comprehensible but speaks with an unfamiliar accent. So we think very naturally in terms of groups, in terms of us versus them.
And really, these are the lessons of coming into the world and being a conscious human being, first learning that me is different from you, and then us is different from them. Do we learn that in a good way, in a straightforward way, or in a way that causes virtually all the problems we have in the world?
I think the answer is both. Morality is really a device for getting individuals to form a group, for getting me to be part of an us, which means being willing to give up something yourself to pay some cost yourself for other people. And that's the core of human morality. It's basic decency. It's altruism. It's caring about other people. But we didn't evolve to be universally cooperative. Anything that evolves biologically has to have some kind of competitive advantage. And there's no competitive advantage to being nice to everybody because you're being nice to everybody. So human morality is really a double-edged sword. It turns me into us, but it turns us against them.
A lot of the great examples in your book come from societies that are facing a set of resources that are limited and a certain amount of adversity. And that seems to produce a level of cooperation. I'm wondering, and it's not universal, of course, but I'm wondering if the planet really does take a huge dive here and humans have to deal with all kinds of limitations, 10 billion people on the planet, deteriorating environment. Is that going to inflame and enforce our moralistic tribal tendencies, or will it revert us to some Hobbesian state of nature where it's everyone for themselves?
Well, I hope it's not the latter, and I'm optimistic that it's not. But I think, you know, what's happened in the modern world is that people who are physically very distant and culturally very distant can have enormous influence. We can bomb people on the other side of the world. We can send life-saving food and medicine to people on the other side of the world. And this is completely absurd, completely unheard of from the perspective of our hunter-gatherer past. And so I think that what's been happening over the last few hundred years and intensely over the last few decades is we're realigning our moral instincts. And I mean instincts broadly, not just in the biological sense, but our gut reactions about how to relate to other people. And I think a lot of what's going on right now in American politics and around the world is a tension between a more global vision of morality, people rallying around abstract ideals that are in some sense not bound to any particular tribe, versus local tribal moralities.
You know, I'd love for you to explain this fast thinking versus slow thinking idea here, because it does seem like one is great if you're a wolf surrounded by enemies, and the other is great if you're, you know, someone on the top of a mountain acting a little bit more like a Buddhist priest.
Right. One way to put the general idea of the book is that there are two different kinds of moral problems, and there are two different kinds of thinking, we call it fast and slow. And progress depends on getting the right kind of thinking lined up with the right kind of problem. So along with David Rand and Martin Novak, we did a set of experiments where we had people play what's called a public goods game. where everybody gets $10, let's say, and they can put their money into a common pool or keep their money. And when the money goes into the common pool, it gets doubled by the experimenter, and then it gets evenly divided among everybody, all four people. So the selfish thing to do is to keep your money. The cooperative thing to do is to put your money in, and that maximizes the amount that gets doubled by the experimenter, and everybody ends up better off. What we found is that if you put people under time pressure, they're more likely to contribute. If you make people stop and think slowly, they're less likely to contribute. And what this suggests is that we have gut reactions that make us cooperative when it's a group of me's trying to form an us. But when it's us versus them, we have very different gut reactions. We have very different gut reactions, as you know, about gay marriage or Obamacare or Israelis versus Palestinians in the Middle East. And so it's those us versus them kinds of problems where our gut reactions get us in trouble and where we need to think a bit more slowly.
So finally, we could really blow it here on planet Earth, but according to your research and according to this book, we are, at least it appears, wired to solve our problems.
Well, we're wired to solve two different kinds of problems. So we're wired to inherit or acquire emotional dispositions that allow us to solve problems that we've already encountered. So for example, if I showed you a picture of a swastika or a guy in a pointy white hood, a part of your brain called the amygdala will probably send a signal saying, ah, that's something kind of bad, something that requires attention. But it's not because you've had necessarily run-ins with Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. It's because you've learned that from other people. And likewise, if you're a kid, you know not to touch the hot stove after you've touched it once, right? So your genes and your cultural experience and your personal experience, all that trial and error experience feeds into your emotions. But we have another way of solving problems. And this is really uniquely human, or at least far more developed in humans than in other species, which is the ability to have a general map of the world and solve problems that we've never solved before. So to just take a personal instance of this, if I said to you, John, I'll give you $1 million if you meet me at the post office in Oxford, Maine in exactly 1 week. You've never been there before, but you can figure it out. You can say, okay.
I can figure that out, Joshua.
Right.
Yeah.
Other animals can't do that, right? And that's an example of slow thinking. It's using our uniquely human capacity to sort of represent cause and effect relationships in the world, to take in new information and to put it all together flexibly to come to a plan of action that's going to get us what we want.
Well, Joshua, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And what do you say, Oxford next Tuesday?
All right. Sounds good. See you there.
Joshua Green, author of Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.